You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody. Happy Halloween. This is the Halloween episode of The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. This is releasing on October 30th. So Halloween is afoot. Very nearby.
Yes, it is. Get your tricks. Get your treats.
Yeah.
Bring a sack.
Yeah. All those things sound slightly pornographic and strange.
They do.
Grab your sack. Get a trick and a treat. Just try not to mix the two.
Yeah, also, be careful. Unless that's your thing.
Be careful where you put your sack. Teabagging, baby.
Yeah.
So welcome. This is we try to pick a seminal film. In years past, we've done trilogies and stuff, and I think we'll get back to that kind of stuff soon. Again, we do miss the double film format because it gave us the chance to kind of mix the class and the trash. And but you know, again, time is just it's a thing right now. And it's just something we got to work through. And we want to be podcasting. So this is what we're doing nowadays. So in saying that, we picked a big one, or at least a very big one for Will, but certainly I think a big one in the horror community, with a big name director in the horror community. One that I recently talked about on a Not a Bomb episode with his Dracula film, which is not a film I recommend people check out. Seriously. It's a bad movie. And you won't hear me say that very often. I mean, but it's a bad movie. But this is Dario Argento's Inferno from 1980. This is one we've kind of went back and forth on. Will and I, we both share a lot of similarities in our cinematic taste. We do have bumps in the road, so to speak. Certain things I like more than he likes and vice versa, as you would, because you're two human beings. But both of us love Italian cinema. It's one of the first things, well, I guess the two things that really kind of brought us together in a lot of ways was Italian cinema and Chinese cinema, or Asian cinema. Maybe just that'd be the better word for it, really, not just Chinese cinema. And, that kind of brought us together. And, then I remember in the history of the show, or in the history of our friendship, me saying that I thought Suspiria was overrated, and, you know, you could have heard a pin drop across the internet, including in Will's house. Now I have not seen Suspiria still to this day in over 20 something years, so I don't know how I still feel about it. But here we are, we're going to go into, so we'll talk about this a little bit when we talk about Dario, cause we haven't talked about him in a while. I can't remember the last Dario film we did. It might've been when you and Todd did Phenomena. Oh, right. Cat of Nine Tails. No, you're right. Cat of Nine Tails. That was the last one we did, which to me is a different type of Dario, right? I think. In a lot of ways, and we'll kind of talk about this again in further detail, this is Gialli-esque, but this is also Argento-esque. I think there's a difference between Argento-esque Gialli and straight-up Gialli that he was doing early on. Like, when I think about those first four or five films, not until it gets to Deep Red do I really feel the Argento-ness kind of start peeking through. And then after that, it just goes full tilt.
Oh, yeah.
And some could argue full tilt to the betterment or to the detriment of Dario. And we'll kind of talk about that. We'll kind of talk about that. I brought up this subject when I was on the Not a Bomb show, and I'm going to bring up the subject to Will as well later on. So we'll get to that. So look forward to that review. I do have some feedback we can talk about here. I believe Walt sent something in. I don't think I've played this voicemail, but you know what? We're going to find out live on the air if I have. So let's see what happens yes. here.
Gentlemen, so nice to have you back together again. And nice to appreciate that you like these little call-ins. Like, I appreciate you bringing me these reviews of fancy European art movies. Speaking of fancy and European, nice to hear that Will got back from his continental voyage, which I have never taken.
Yeah.
In the future, Will, if you want to, you know, I don't know, take me aboard as a stowaway inside a large steamer trunk, a la the Marx Brothers and Night at the Opera. Well, I'm available. Let's do that.
Noted.
So many box sets coming out, gentlemen. I have to pick and choose, but I am looking at the Lost and Found set by Vinegar Syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
10 rarities, including a documentary on hobos. Apparently, most of the footage faked, including Coleman Francis playing one of the hobos. I don't know, kind of up my alley. I don't know what that says about me. You're this or that for this week. Peter Falk or Klaus Kinski? Thanks, ooh. Guys.
Ooh, man. What I wouldn't do for a Peter Falk, Klaus Kinski buddy cop movie.
Wow.
I mean, talk about a missed opportunity. I feel like Falk would have punched him in the mouth, though.
Yeah.
I feel like there would have been some violence on that set. I mean, we know Kinski brings the violence.
He does.
But I feel like Falk is not a guy to fuck with. Or wasn't a guy to fuck with. Let's get that out of the way first. Peter Falk or Klaus Kinski? Where do you stand? It's a little tougher than you would think.
It is. I will be forthright in saying I really admire Falk. I've seen some Columbo. I like some of his films. Was it Mikey and Nicky? He's really good in.
Yeah.
He's a good actor. But I didn't grow up with him kind of woven into my life like some of our friends, i.e. Mike White and others.
I mean, he's a pop culture icon, right?
Yeah, absolutely he is. Mm-hmm. And for good reason. But for me, just more in sort of the wheelhouse of the stuff I love and kind of not necessarily grown up with, but has sort of been in my life longer, it's Kinski. Kinski did a lot of Euro horror and spaghetti westerns and my favorite spaghetti of all time, The Great Silence. To me, it just, there's more for me with Kinski than there is with Falk, but both are great.
So I'm with you on that one. I love Peter Falk. I think he's a great actor, great character actor, very unique. Again, very unique look. And, you know, the disheveled look and, of course, the glass eye and whatnot. It makes him very unique in cinema history. But, man, when I think of unique, I don't know that there was ever a crazier actor on screen or a more troublesome actor.
Off screen.
And on screen. Anywhere, for that matter, than one Klaus Kinski. He is the cult actor of cult actors. His biography is insane. The one he wrote or ghost wrote himself, where he claims to have made love to his own daughter. He is one of the most disturbing and strangest things that has ever graced our screen. And don't get me wrong, not championing any of that behavior. He was a total jerk from what I understand. But man, he brings a levity to everything he does that, and he's made some true garbage. I mean, some of the worst movies I've ever seen have Klaus Kinski in them. And yet, somehow, some way, he is always interesting in them. And for the record, I don't think he probably really slept with his own daughter. I think he loved to piss people off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he loved to just rile feathers and shock and all those things. Very angry little man. And everything I've ever seen about him is just that. He was very temperamental, just loved to argue and loved to fight. And you meet people like this in your life sometimes. You can choose whether to be around them or not, obviously, but you do meet people like this in your life sometimes, right? These people who just, they get their energy from being counterproductive. And they're productive because they're causing everybody else to be counterproductive. It's very bizarre. But people are like that. I mean, I get my energy from weirdly reading a book. People get energy from all kinds of things. Playing sports. For you, it might be working out. I know you like to work out. Obviously, watching movies is something for both of us. Yeah.
Carrot top.
Yeah. Yeah, using that carrot top juice. Carrot juice. That's what you're using.
I refrain from the carrot juice, but
you never know. I think even Sly got a little bit of the carrot juice.
Oh, he definitely got the carrot juice.
The HGH carrot juice. But I definitely got to go Kinski. I like Peter Falk, and I did grow up with Columbo a little bit. He probably wasn't as prominent in my household as Kojak, though, or Beretta. Those were probably bigger ones. As far as those cops go. So I want to talk about that Vinegar Syndrome set he's talking about. It's called The Lost Picture Show. It's 10 films that I guess they've had for a while and they haven't put out. So the interesting thing about it, it's got a documentary on there as well called Against the Grain, which is about boutique DVD video companies, which is reason enough, I think, maybe to get it. And I'm definitely going to get this. But this has films like The Las Vegas Strangler, Beware the Black Widow, Violated, Barbara, Red Midnight, The Last of the American Hobos, What's Love, The Sex Serum of Dr. Blake, which is the original cut of Voodoo Heartbeat. Never seen either, so I don't know. And then there's a kids film in here that I have wanted to talk about on this show, and I didn't think anybody knew about it but me. And I grabbed this a long time ago via ill means because there was no way to get a hold of it and have put it on the back burner so many times over the years. So maybe now we'll finally get around to it. But it's a film called The Rare Blue Apes of Cannibal Isle.
I don't know if I've ever even heard of this.
The most bizarre thing about this is it's a kiddie film, a children's film. It's a musical, but it's also a puppet ape cannibal film. So,
wow, that's ticking a lot of boxes.
Yeah. And as if anybody knows me and knows Will, we're super adventurous. And of course, you know, I see a title like The Rare Blue Apes of Cannibal Isle and I think, well, we got to talk about that. So yes. Maybe this will give us an opportunity to actually talk about that film. So we'll see. But I'm definitely planning on picking it up, Walt. And I'm assuming he will as well. So. Vinegar Syndrome, man, still doing the Lord's work. Thank God for them, right? I mean, you know, we were on board early. You turned me on to them very early. And they started out kind of slow, but, man, they've really, wow. I mean, some of the stuff they're putting out now, unbelievable. I mean, I got two things in my cart right now, and one of them being, and this is a weird, they put out these ultra sets that I like. And I've got all five of them. I think there's six of them, maybe five or six of them. And they're putting out another one. It's Daryl, the that film D.A.R. Yeah. Not a film that I would think that I would need to own in a glorified 4K restoration / super ultra edition. But these boxes they put out and these sets they put out are amazing. I have the Sidekicks one, which is not a good Chuck Norris movie. Yeah.
And Ernie Reyes Jr. jam.
Yeah. And yeah, Ernie Reyes Jr. That's right. And, they're just putting out great stuff. I mean, they're putting Blood-Sucking Freaks out on 4K, dude.
Wild.
It's just insane to me. And, again, I'm very happy they exist, and I hope they continue to exist. Honestly, I think this is where the video market is headed, is more boutique label than anything. Yeah, they're a little pricier, but if you love movies, you'll justify that cost. So.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, Walt, looking forward to that box set. Definitely going to check it out. And definitely going to rewatch Daryl, which is a film I didn't think I liked the first time I saw it, and I probably didn't. But, hey, you know what? It's a nice set. I'm going to buy it.
Can we give some flowers to Simon Windsor? Like Daryl, The Phantom.
Yeah.
Under, Harley Davidson, the Marlboro Man.
Yeah, man.
Frequently, take, you know, however you feel about that. Crocodile Dundee.
Harlequin. Underrated. That's what underrated. I'll say.
And yeah. Underrated.
Underrated. Fan
and Harley Davidson are two films that I'd love to talk about with you on the show sometime because I love both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Came to them later in life, loved them both.
Yeah, yeah. He's a fun filmmaker. Really was. Yeah. I don't think he's working anymore. I think he may have passed away. I'm not sure, but
he's alive.
Oh, okay. I'll have
to know. He's 80 years old. Still kicking, but he's hung it up, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe he'll come back and make a film in his 80s, kind of like we talked about last week.
Yeah.
Let's get into what we've been watching. Thanks, Walt, as always. Sorry. Hate to get into my Blu-ray shopping behind the scenes, but sometimes you got to get into it.
Oh, man, it's topical.
It's topical. It's topical for all of us film lovers. I think I'm going to have to pick up that Bloodsucking Freaks. I don't even like that movie. But see, it's one of those things that I have to have. Actually, they're putting, I don't know if you know this, I think it's one of the few Troma films you like. Mother's Day? I think they're putting that out on 4K as well.
Yeah, I like it. Troma, I like Combat Shock, which I don't know if I'll watch at this point in my life, but I do like it.
Yeah, I haven't seen Combat Shock since VHS.
Not sure that I'm gearing up for a rewatch, although I do really like it. And of course, they distributed The Stabilizer. So
yeah, so they'll forever hold a place in our heart for that, right?
Yeah, yeah, there's some good stuff in there. And, you know, the world's a better place, I guess, with Kaufman's brand. But, you know.
Yeah. 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 Some hit or miss. Can't wait to see how that, Walt, let me know what you think of this. Can't wait to see the Toxic Avenger remake with Peter Dinklage, which I thought was a joke, but it's not.
You thought wrong.
No, I thought it was a joke. The same way I thought Joker 2 was a joke, but these aren't jokes.
No.
They're really happening.
You think these are costumes? These are real life.
Yeah. I'm wondering if Joker 2 is going to be a musical like Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix has said.
Oh, wow.
I don't know about that part.
Lady Gaga.
Yeah, I know.
But I think she's going to be good in the film for what it's worth.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think she will be too.
She's going to crush it.
I think the movie could be. It's either one of the biggest gambles ever. And I totally understand why they're making a sequel to it. That movie, don't forget, the Joker movie made $1 billion.
I know.
But. They're either going to, that really is the height of comicdom right there, because that is, you know, it's not a feel good movie or anything like that, but
not a family movie.
Yeah. And it generates $1 billion. It's insane. But, mm-hmm. They're either going to just kill the franchise, which maybe that's what they want to do. Or maybe they had such a success with that first one, they feel like they can just gamble the whole house, which is also something they might just do. I don't know. Or it could end up being a masterpiece. I mean, hell, anything can happen, right?
Well, that's where we're at, yeah.
We'll see what happens. All right, let's get into what we've been watching.
All right, so rewatch of – this was sort of a people's choice. We were having a bit of a bonanza at a friend's house with our kids who are around the same age. And the consensus was a watch for his son and a rewatch for our guys of Freddy versus Jason.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Ronnie Yu. So this one holds up as well as expected. This one I like. We all like. It's fun.
Yeah, everything I like about that one involves Freddy versus Jason. Everything I dislike about that one involves the teenagers.
Oh, man. Yeah, they're not great.
The acting. I don't want to say anything bad about the actors. I really don't, because they're given a, in my opinion, an almost insurmountable task.
This is true.
But it's one of those movies where it drives me crazy that they explain everything that's going on, like, all the time. No.
I'm willing to bet you, Ronnie, you didn't want to explain, and then the studio was like, no, we have to explain. No, you don't have to explain. Just go with it.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, let's just buy in. You got Freddy Krueger in there, so you can just use dream logic. Just go with it.
Yeah. I think this one's fun. It's got some fun pieces. It's weird. In my house, I'm the only guy that's Team Freddy, which, you know. Yeah. Freddy's not very PC. He's weird, man. He's always dropping. He's always calling women bitches, and he's just
He's a weird cat.
He's a weird cat, and he's a bit of a dinosaur. So
yeah.
My kids for Jason, they're all about Team Jason. So we'll kind of trash talk watching this one, and we kind of go back and forth on the ending, and I'm like, yeah, but Freddy won. Freddy got the last laugh. And they're like, no, he didn't. So, you know, but it was a good rewatch. It's a fun one. I remember seeing this one in the theaters. I think you did the characters justice. So
yeah. And that's a filmmaker that I feel like he's not celebrated enough.
No, he's a filmmaker, man.
Yeah, he's a really good filmmaker. I don't even know if he's working lately what.
That's a good question.
I'm gonna look that up while you're talking.
Yeah, that's a good question. So next up was one. So I wanted to watch a lot of fun, newer stuff that was gonna kind of go over for the whole family. Hence Totally Killer and a few others that I'd sort of had on the docket. My wife had picked one that was on my list. I'm not sure if you've seen this one. It's a few years old. It made the rounds. Freaky. Have you seen Freaky?
Oh, I haven't. I meant to see it, honestly, because I heard mixed things. But I heard some people I like call it genius, and some people I like call it one of the worst things they've ever seen.
Wow. So I guess I'd fall somewhere less than genius, but definitely far from the worst thing I've ever seen. So it's interesting, you know, we've got these kind of high concept slasher films where last week I watched Back to the Future meets Scream. This week it's Freaky Friday by way of slasher with Vince Vaughn. So I like this one. I think it's fun. The practical effects are good.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Vince Vaughn's having a lot of fun with it. He's a guy I've always liked, you know, despite being really a heavy check casher, but you got to pay the bills.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that sometimes I love him and sometimes I loathe him.
Yeah, sometimes like, okay, I've had enough. I don't need any more Vince Vaughn.
Yeah. No more Vince Vaughn for a couple months.
Yeah, a little bit of a heavy dose. But it's good. Like I said, I think you could do a lot worse.
It's, yeah, Ronnie Yu, 73 years old now.
Yeah.
Last film he made was in 2013, Saving General Yang.
Period piece, which makes sense.
Yeah. He did Fearless, the Jet Li film.
Yeah.
And right after Freddy versus Jason. And and did Formula 51 too. That's one.
Speaking of master check cashers, Sam Jackson and what's his name from Trainspotting? Robert Carlyle, right?
Yeah. And he honestly, he did my favorite of the Chucky films, which is Bride of Chucky. I love that.
I've never seen Bride.
Oh, I love that one.
And I didn't know he made it. And I didn't realize it was him that made Formula 51. I might go back and watch that now, knowing that it's Ronnie Yu.
Yeah, I might. I've never seen Formula 51 either. I might check that out as well. But Bride of Chucky. Yeah,
I avoided it.
I recommend Bride of Chucky. That'd be a good one for you and the kids and everybody to watch. I'd advise checking that one out.
I've been, you know what? That's come up a few times this month with people. And I've said, no, I've never seen it. Because those were some of the first kind of gateway ones that we watched when the kids were getting into more sort of proper horror. First three, I think, are fun. Third one has that great finale at the toy, or is it the second one at the toy factory? But anyway, I'm going to have to check out Bride.
Yeah, you're going to have to. I want to hear your opinion on Bride. Yeah. At the very least, you will tell me that Jennifer Tilly's a gorgeous specimen of a lady. You'll tell me that.
I will tell you that. I'll tell you that now, and I will tell you that later.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. She's also 63 years old nowadays. Sometimes I never feel older than when some of the women that I find cinematically like devastatingly gorgeous, when I find out that they're a full generation older than me, it blows my mind.
That is pretty wild.
Yes, I know.
It's pretty wild. Oh no, Katherine Heigl's in that though. Oh.
She's not bad in that though.
Really?
This is before she Heigled it.
Okay, so before she went final form Heigl? Okay,
yeah, good. Before she went final Heigl. That rhymes.
Yeah, that's right, man.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a fan of she gets on my nerves too. Terrible.
Yeah. Next up, one I don't need to spend a lot of time on. Beloved staple in many a household this time of year is The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. I will rant though and just say quickly, it's a shame Apple TV's got this thing. They sit on it. This should be available on on as many resources as possible for generations to enjoy. I mean, this is an institution.
Yeah, I understand what they're doing to kind of give it that, you know, remember when we were kids, you know, you only saw that around Halloween.
Yep.
Look, I understand the dynamic, but we live in a different time. We live in a time where everything's available all the time. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to probably watch that unless they start to feel the Halloween itch come August, September.
Yep.
And maybe into November. So nobody's really probably going to watch that often. So, yeah, just make it available.
Come on. Do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah. For the record, I am the one of the weirdest people when it comes to Charlie Brown specials. My favorite has always been the one. I don't know what it's called. I can't remember which one it is. Is it the river raft race one? The race one.
Yeah. I was talking about this one with someone recently.
Where they end up in France or something, and there's like this ghostly image up in the. Or is that the one? I don't know. I need to look.
I don't remember. I don't know. Yeah. There's even a Valentine's one that I heard about like in my kid's lifetime that I didn't know existed. Or maybe I knew. I don't remember now. But
yeah. I mean, obviously the two everybody talks about is the Great Pumpkin. And I get it. Well, that and I guess. Is there a Christmas one? I guess there's a Christmas one.
Yeah, there's a great Christmas. But the Christmas tree. Charlie Brown Christmas tree.
Oh, yeah. That's right. What am I thinking?
Yeah. With the big Linus speech, man.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Scene. Yeah. That make or break moment. That's right. The Jean-Claude Van Damme scene in that.
Yeah, he gets that monologue, man. He gets that JCVD monologue. So it's excellent. And then there's Thanksgiving one, which I have to imagine is bigger.
Oh, yeah. That one's good, actually. Yeah. That might be the one I'm thinking about, maybe. I don't know. I'm getting ready to look up Charlie Brown specials. Nice. Because I love Charlie Brown, obviously.
Oh, love. So next up was one I watched. Again, this I was looking for fun. It was just Braden and I. We threw it on. We both absolutely loved it and have been singing its praises. Super fun, Deathgasm.
Oh yeah, the heavy metal one.
Yeah. Have you seen this?
No. I got it confused when I saw you post it. I got it confused with that one that was metal esque and kind of Mad Maxy. And I can't remember, Wormwood, I think it's what it's called.
Oh, Wormwood. This is so far removed from Wormwood.
Yeah, Wormwood left a bad taste in my mouth.
And my mouth, too.
Yeah, and I was like, you know, Deathgasm came out shortly after or around that same time. And I was like, you know what? They didn't get it right with Wormwood. They're not going to get it right with Deathgasm. But since then, I've heard good things. I've heard some mixed things, but I've heard good things for the most part.
So I'll tell you this. I think Wormwood is Australian. This is a Kiwi film. Mm-hmm. Kiwis have done pretty right by horror.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a huge sort of horror comedy guy, but I feel like, and you're obviously more of a metal guy than I am, but I can appreciate a good riff.
Yeah.
Hot lick. This one to me has a great energy. It's under 90 minutes. It has sort of a likability and an energy and sort of a love lettery feel that endeared itself to me. It's got it's a very gloopy, splattery film. It's sort of early Peter Jackson meets sort of Sam Raimi meets sort of Shaun of the Dead. I quite liked it. Braden and I loved it. It probably was his favorite film we've watched this season.
It's effects heavy, right?
It's very effects heavy.
Practical, mostly?
Mostly all practical.
Okay.
I will forewarn anyone who thinks, oh, great, I can watch it with my kid. So my son just turned 13, our younger son.
Yeah, and, you know, you've raised him uniquely. You know, not in a bad way. I mean, but he's a horror buff.
He's a horror kid, and we've seen some things. Now,
my kid is becoming that as well.
Oh, yeah. He's right there too, right? So,
yep.
But I will forewarn you, there is one of the demons gets attacked by our heroes with a rather large dildo and some anal beads.
Okay.
So,
well, I mean,
I didn't see this coming.
Did the demon. I mean, come on. It's just another Saturday night in GGT TMCville or whatever.
That's right, hips or lips. But you know, but here's the thing. I feel like I'm at an age where when I was 13, like, not the end of the world if he sees this. It'd be different if he saw someone get, like, you know, raped. I mean, seeing like a latex heavy demon get assaulted with like a penis, the anal bead thing went over his head. So they jokingly call them a rosary, and the character sniffs it. And
yeah, so I've heard that rosary anal bead joke that's been around for ages.
That's a good one. I surprisingly had never heard it. Thankfully, I've never smelled it. So be forewarned. You know, you get that in this. But again,
I'll check it out. I'll add it to my list.
It's not mean spirited, right? So, you know, that's going to be a judgment call, I guess. How comfortable you are talking about why is there a large rubber penis in the parents' bedroom? But. You can roll the dice on that if you want. Never came up.
I'm going through the, a change of subject. I'm going through the, it's a rubber penis. Charlie Brown is actually number 28 on the Charlie Brown specials. No, I'm just joking.
Yes.
That would be a good one though. Charlie Brown explains dildos to the peanuts. Yeah, sure. Well, there's one called It's Arbor Day, Charlie Brown. I don't think I've ever seen that one.
That's a deep cut. I'll be honest with you, as a Canadian, I don't even know what Arbor Day is.
That's a National Tree Day.
Oh, well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
I guess. I think that's what it is, right?
Arborist. It checks out.
Yeah. I'm going through these as we talk, so go ahead.
I just got two more quickies. Halloween 4 was William's pick. I'll say this. I think this one's solid. The opening shots are really solid. Set up the atmosphere really good. There's some good effects in this one. I love the twist at the back end. I think it's a pretty inspired ending. I love that Loomis, you know, and of course Pleasance is really hamming it up and classing it up at the same time. I love that Loomis, when the reveal happens, he goes to shoot the character revealed. They love that. By and large, I think it's solid. It's under 90 minutes. Jason, Michael Myers is really mean in this. He's got this fixation with sort of like pushing through people's skin with his bare hands. Like, they went to the well a few times with that effect in this one. And I always forget that Sasha Jensen of Dazed and Confused fame is in this. He's like one of the boyfriends, one of the characters.
Interesting.
Yeah. So this, not to be, well, I'm not even going to go there. This, yeah, anyway, I'll leave that one alone. There's a character in this. Yeah, I'll leave the Sammy search for later. Last one, you know, Christmas has their classics. Halloween has their classics. This is a top five horror film for me in terms of love, and that's Demons.
Oh, yeah. We reviewed this and Demons 2 a long time ago. Man. And I'm one of the few, maybe you are too. I can't remember what we talked about, but we're two of the few that probably enjoyed Demons 2, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though it's not even close to the first one, but it's still... It has its moments.
It has its moments, absolutely. So, yeah, this is a staple, man. Staple, top five favorite horror film for me. It's just the energy. It's great. What a setup.
You really
It's funny because Lamberto and Dario were going to come up this week.
Yeah, they worked together on this one, actually.
Hmm.
What's interesting about your week there is, you know, Metalhead... horror, a lot of metalhead horror in there.
You know, that is right.
That's very interesting.
That is, speaking, keeping that theme going with Inferno, really not metalhead, but like rock sort of Emerson.
I totally agree. Dario Argento is one of the early kind of metal adapters to horror films. For better or worse, yeah. Sometimes very mixed results, but Race for Your Life, Charlie Brown. Is the one that I like.
I'd rather see Race with the Devil, Charlie Brown.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Oh, but, amazing.
But I don't think that's the one where they actually go to France. I'm trying to figure out the one where they're in France. I can't figure out which one that is. But it's where they end up, a couple of them end up in like a rainy, kind of like a horse stable, and they kind of stay the night there, and there's like this ghostly figure up in the window. Or maybe I am mixing that up with the Fat Albert Halloween special, which is another special I love, by the way. Fat Albert, obviously problematic nowadays because of Bill Cosby and everything, but I love that Halloween special. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but it's quite good.
Which one is this?
The Fat Albert Halloween special.
Oh, good question. I love Fat Albert.
Yeah.
It's a good one. I feel like I've seen it.
It's a good one. Okay. Neither here nor there. We're moving on. I'm sure there's somebody out there that's a professional on these things and they know more than us. Let me get into what I've been watching. A couple things I watched. I did a rewatch randomly for no reason not for no reason. Until I seen Dario Argento's Dracula, I used to think that Paul Morrissey's Blood for Dracula was maybe one of the worst Dracula films.
Yep.
I have come to quite enjoy Paul Morrissey's Blood for Dracula.
Nice.
The Udo Kier film, Andy Warhol produced. And I watched it again because I was like, is it really that bad? Which is a question my son has asked me because he had a podcast or like a video podcast for a little while. And I would talk about how movies are bad. And he would say, you know, is it really that bad? and it kind of made me think, well, I don't know, was it really that bad? You know, sometimes you have these visceral responses to a film, right? And then you go back 20 years later and you're like, you know what? It wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Or actually, it was amazing. I wouldn't say Paul Morrissey's and Andy Warhol's Dracula is amazing, but it's certainly interesting. And this kind of got me to my point last week when I discussed the this or that of the wooden stake or the Christ-like figure or the Christ-like power to disavow a vampire. And in this film, Cure just kind of walks into rooms. He kind of walks around daylight. He just kind of shields himself from the sun, kind of like, you know, an older person with like skin issues or something. So he kind of functions in the daylight. He's interesting. Another thing that's interesting about Cure's vampire in this film, he's almost like a heroin addict. Like, he has to have virgin blood. He cannot have any blood that's been tainted. So what this film does offer you is a lot of naked little Joe D'Alessandro. And a lot of naked women, and it's heavy on the sex. I think it was rated X when it was released originally. The sex is very tame by modern standards, but there is a lot of thrusting. So obviously it would still kind of be awkward to watch in certain crowds. But because Judd D'Alessandro is sleeping with all the women except one in the castle, Kira keeps inadvertently and almost comedically eating the wrong sister. And what's kind of interesting about it is it's so repulsive. He gets so ill when he has bad blood that you have these prolonged sequences of him vomiting. And it's just so bizarre. And it's such a weird setup. And yet somehow it works. There's scenes, too, where you can tell that his vampire kind of influenced maybe Del Toro's bloody blood vampires in Blade 2, where it's more like a sickness. Because there's one point where he's licking blood off the floor, which is just repulsive to begin with. And almost like a rat-like, almost like creature-like. So you can tell this film has some influence and some people saw it. And of course, it was a cult film. When I was growing up, it was...
Oh, big time. That was, and Flesh for Frankenstein,
yeah,
right?
both of those were. Flesh for Frankenstein and this, mostly because of the nudity and the gore, not because of the adequacy or the inadequacy of the filmmaking. And Paul Morrissey's an interesting filmmaker. You know, he made some other films with Joe D'Alessandro. And, you know, kind of explored nudity and sexuality. And him and Warhol were kind of into that kind of stuff for a little while. Trash cinema, some think, some say. Some have kind of look back on it now and kind of call it art cinema. It's definitely art cinema. The quality of the art, I guess, lies in the beholder here. But it's certainly unique. And I can't fault it for that. So it popped up on Criterion and I just wanted to rewatch it. Because that's one of the first films that I was like, wow, Criterion's an interesting label, was when they released this and Flesh for Frankenstein on Laserdisc.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought to myself, wow, that's interesting. And that's when I realized it's one of those things, one of those moments where you think to yourself, okay, so the Criterion Collection isn't just about the most highly rated. It's also about the most interesting films. And you could say a lot of things about Blood for Dracula. You can't say it's uninteresting.
That's right.
It's odd, and its tone and what it goes for. And it was a good rewatch. I was glad I rewatched it. And actually, it's a lot more breezy than I remember it being. And Kier is just, I mean, talk about an actor who the camera just loves the way he looks. Man, he just, the camera loves him.
It does. Little piece of trivia about that film and one of its stars. Did you know that Little Joe never once gave it away?
Yeah, what? You mean didn't show anything?
Everybody to pay and pay.
Oh, really? There we go. Yeah. Joe, it's a weird movie because Joe D'Alessandro is using his own voice and never hides his accent.
The Brooklyn accent.
So you have this heavy New York accent in this kind of period film with European actors. So it's just weird from the get-go. It's a weird movie, but I'm thankful it exists. Almost 50 years old, that movie. How about that? Does that make you feel old?
It does.
1974. I checked out a documentary on Hulu called Monster Inside, America's Most Extreme Haunted House. This is about a gentleman that does extreme haunts, he says. Really, it just seems like an excuse to torture people.
Is this McCamey Manor or whatever?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
With this is, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know how I feel about this. I put in, when I posted on Facebook, I put on there, chalk this up to me trying to understand things I don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't understand why anybody would sign up to be tortured. To me, this isn't fear. This is, well, I guess it is fear, but it's kind of like pushing your, I guess maybe it's more adrenaline junkie or pushing your limits. But some of the stuff that ends up happening, I mean, people really get hurt.
Yeah.
And you're signing over.
Used.
Yeah, you're signing over your, you know, I mean, in the waiver, it says you may lose teeth. You may this, you may that. You might have scars for the rest of your life, mental and physical. I just don't know. I don't know. Look, I'm glad I live in a place where you can do pretty much wherever you want to do and make a living at it. But it just seems kind of, I mean, maybe I'm getting old. It just seems kind of irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
And slightly a little too dangerous. Like somebody's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's putting saw-like contraptions on people. He's putting like these big tanks on people's heads and he's dumping water in there and letting it fill up.
Yeah. People are like, yeah, basically getting waterboarded or they're eating their own vomit and
And eating worms.
I'm surprised this hasn't happened. I'm surprised someone hasn't died already.
I'm surprised he hasn't been arrested.
He's moved states a few times.
Yeah. You know, he's moved around. I'm just kind of surprised that nothing like that's happened. I mean, you've seen, I think there was a guy in Canada that got arrested for special effects or something being too realistic. I can't remember the name of that gentleman. Maybe he made like a short gore film and it was maybe, you know, and there's these films that are, I don't know. I'm kind of befuddled by the whole thing, to be honest with you. I don't get it. And they take the angle that some people, you know, come back from war. Some people are survivors of abuse and they need this adrenaline. They need this fix. They need this challenge. I see what they're going for there, but I just don't, again, I'm not judging the documentary for the record. The documentary's fine. It's not a great made documentary. It's fine, but I'd be interested to talk to this Russ McCamey guy and see what goes on inside his head, because it seems to me like he's got some issues.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That was interesting with that one woman, the neighbor, who sort of unwittingly, or she kind of got roped into going, and then she got roped in again, and just, it's a weird one.
It's a weird one. And it kind of gets into the dynamics, too, of the power play and how he's got all these he's got these young girlfriends.
Yes. And it's a very...
And it gets kind of skeevy there.
It does. You know which one is a little more wholesome? No, not a little. It's a lot more wholesome. It's on Shudder. I want to say it's from New Zealand. It's called Spookers.
Yeah.
It's about this haunted house somewhere, presumably in New Zealand. And just kind of, it's a more wholesome kind of communal feel about the this haunted house.
Yeah, kind of, you know, I've seen some good ones. There's some good ones about American haunted houses, too. Actually, the McCamey Manor kind of is brought up in one of them. I can't remember the name of that documentary, but it's brought up in one of them. But it's not deep dive. This is deep dive. And I don't know. I just kind of left it kind of feeling sad.
Oh, yeah.
And just kind of, I don't know if repulsed is the word, but certainly kind of turned off. And I don't think you can use the word haunt. I don't think that's. I think that leaves you haunted as opposed to going on a hunt. You know, my son just went on a haunted forest thing last night. And, you know, that's just about jump scares and people jumping out of stuff and, you know, trying to freak you out and rubber mask and stuff. And it works. If he'd went somewhere where I think he'd have been physically touched, I don't know how, well, I know how I'd feel about that. I'd probably be a little upset. Obviously being underage, but even being adult, I don't know that, I would hope he never signs up for anything like this. So, you know, again, maybe I'm being persnickety and old, but it just, if you check it out, you'll see what I'm saying. I mean, it's kind of repulsive behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. I don't think I know I'm not a fan. As a matter of fact, last, but certainly not least, I watched what has quickly became, and you and I agree with this. We reviewed it a long time ago, maybe one of the most perfect horror films ever made. And I did a rewatch of Night of the Creeps, which I reviewed on Not a Bomb with Troy and Brad. They're doing they've invited me to be on their Halloween episodes this year. And man, that movie just keeps getting better, doesn't it?
It does, man. It's got everything in it, right? Like, such a throwback to kind of 50s sci-fi and Harryhausen effects and zombies and kind of 70s cop, Dirty Harry, cool stuff in trench coats and, you know, 80s kind of sex teen comedy, bullies, and just everything. It's something for everyone, man.
Yeah.
Decker, should have been more prolific and more successful. What a shame.
It reminds me of, and I really didn't kind of put it together, but it reminds me of that perfect amalgamation of genres like Big Trouble in Little China was.
Yeah, great call. They really meld it. That to me is the testament to someone who really loves that stuff. And it really is a love letter to a lot of things they love that inspired them creatively and artistically and so forth.
Really a shame that Fred Decker had two bombs. Thankfully, he had those two bombs because they're both pretty amazing. Sadly, well, actually, it was three bombs that put him down. But those two bombs are great films in retrospect. Monster Squad and Night of the Creeps. RoboCop 3, not as much. But, you know, obviously he's still writing. He still works with Shane Black a little bit here and there because they're friends. But, man, I just, I hate that he's not making movies anymore. I hate that.
It's a shame. There's a, you know, we would have had a handful. I mean, he was definitely a shining light. Just someone that I think is, I would, dare I say, sort of universally adored in our realms.
Oh yeah. No. Those two films.
I can't think of anything that goes, man, fuck Fred Decker.
Yeah. No, I can't think of any. And maybe some people don't like Monster Squad as much as Night of the Creeps or vice versa. But I don't think I've ever met anybody that doesn't like at least one of the two, if not
and
both.
There's a joy. There's such a joy to both films.
Well, I brought that up on the show with Troy and them that I think what's interesting about Fred Decker, he's actually one of the first filmmakers of the kind of video generation to kind of hit it big. And yeah. I think he might have been ahead of his time.
I think so, because if you think of films that had the spirit that he had almost 40 years ago, mm-hmm. and if you transfer that to today, and I was talking about this last night, actually, how our generation is very steeped in nostalgia in terms of a lot of merchandise, and we want to show our kids the stuff we grew up with. And, you know, that was our generation. And I feel like if he had to make these films now, God, like...
Yeah.
He would have just been like everyone's letterbox darling.
Yeah. I mean, if we got younger listeners who are just learning about film or whatnot, Fred Decker is essentially, he was Kevin Smith, Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino before those guys.
Yeah. He was one of us, it felt like, right? A guy who loved
him and Spike Lee. Him and Spike Lee would be the two I always kind of throw up there to think of. They were the first two that I realized they grew up watching the same stuff I did.
I'd be curious what Marty Scorsese, if he's seen Night of the Creeps and Monster Squad, and where they sit for him.
Yeah, as
someone who loves film.
Yeah. I know
and
he
doesn't thumb his nose at genre film either.
No. He likes Ari Aster a lot. I know that.
Yeah.
He likes them a lot. So,
which he's going to come up today for me, funnily enough.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. That's everything I watched. I haven't watched anything else, man.
Nice.
We got very some. Nice. Do we have any time?
I think we got time, man. It's not time for anything except this or that.
So time for the tot, this or that. Time for the tot. Tit for the tot. Tot for the tit? Tit for the tat? I don't know. It sounds like it's getting kind of dark and weird there. All right, what do you got? I don't have anything this week. I don't think so. I was trying to think of something Argento, but I don't want to do any of his films. Actually, I do have one, but I'll let you go first.
I'm going to blast you right out of the gates with one that I think is unfair. The Shining or The Thing?
Shame on you. Shame on you, for real. That's that is unfair. Even you know it's unfair, and it's unfair.
Dirty.
That is dirty. Dirty pool, sir. Dirty. You pissed in the pool on this one.
Oh, man. Snickers in the pool, man.
Yeah. Goddamn. Two of my favorite filmmakers, too.
I know.
Of all time. Well, I mean, I got to be honest with you. This is hard on me. I know it's hard on you too. Oh, you may have an angle, but I know it's brutal. I don't know if I can talk you through this one because I'm thinking of all the justifications I can make for one, but it's the same justifications I can make for the other. So for the record, I'm a huge Shining fan. Some don't love it as much as I do. I'm a huge fan of The Shining. It was one of the first horror films that really unnerved me and put me in a place that I didn't understand as a kid. I didn't know the feelings I was having. I didn't understand, you know, it's kind of like dream logic or nightmare logic cinema. And I didn't really understand what was happening. And I was very little. I was only like 7 or 8 years old. I saw it very early. Right when we first got a VCR, boom. I mean, it was early 80s. And again, I've told the story. My mom and dad, for whatever reason, they paid thousands of dollars for a VHS. Thankfully, they did, because I love movies and stuff because of it. But I remember getting a hold of this. I think I may have watched it on Betamax or something.
Nice.
And I remember my parents saying, yeah, we're going to watch a scary movie. Not realizing that they are completely scarring their child. My brother was little, so he passed out. You know, he went to sleep. But me, I was transfixed. I mean, I was hooked from that point on. I saw that early. I saw American Werewolf in London early. I saw The Thing early. So this is tough. You throw American Werewolf in London in there, and now you're just talking like, you know, like an atomic bomb being dropped on those three horror films and how important they are to me. Jesus, I don't know. I don't know the answer to this, because here's the prop. Well, here's the angle I'm going to take. Okay. And it's maybe not fair to Kubrick and my favorite Shining and my favorite film, one of my favorite films of his. But the thing about Kubrick is I love all of his films almost equally. Carpenter, there are some hits and misses, but The Thing is like top two, like easily. It's either his best film or his second best film on any given day.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go that route because of that. As time goes on, I love it more and more and more. I do The Shining as well, but that, yeah, I'm going to go with Carpenter's Thing. I'm not going to give it any more justification other than it's a master filmmaker's first or second greatest film. And I don't think The Shining is in Kubrick's top three. So there's my logic. There's the only logic you're going to get out of me on this one.
But I think your logic is bang on.
Yeah.
I also tend towards The Thing. I would say for my money, The Thing is like the perfect horror film. Like when I say Thing or Texas Chainsaw, and I think about those two are very different, but just really the genre is so elevated. You know, they really are master films. Yeah. I got to go with The Thing as well. I love The Shining. I love that it's this.
It's not a perfect movie, though.
No, it's not, but it's ambitious and it's dense and it doesn't hold your hand. And there's a lot of Easter eggs eggs.
It's a perfect Kubrickian film.
It is. No, that's agreed. And you know, King may hate it. I love it. I think it's incredible. I hear the music from the opening and I get chills and I just want to watch it right away. And it's funnily enough, they're both very cold films, literally.
Yeah. Both snow based. Yeah.
Snow based, man. Yeah. No, I got to go with The Thing as well for all the reasons you said.
Yeah. I mean, The Thing, I mean, Carpenter to me, he's made two or three of the greatest genre movies ever made.
Hands down.
And Kubrick has made two or three of the greatest films ever made.
Without any qualifiers, yeah.
Yeah. So that is an unfair question. Yes. My question, this or that is going to be so much more of a wet turd compared to that one. It's going to be unbelievable.
Give it to me. Give me the wet turd.
Dario Argento's The Card Player or Dario Argento's Sleepless?
Ooh, I actually kind of like both.
Oh, that's why I brought these up, because these are actually two later cycle ones that I think kind of get shit on, and they're not bad.
No, they're solid. I'm going to go with Sleepless.
Ah, yes. I agree with this.
Yeah, I like Sleepless. It's a little nastier.
Max von Sydow.
Yeah, yeah. I classing it up.
Cashing a check, one or the other.
Or a little column A, a little column B. Yeah, I wonder if he's in Formula 52.
He would be if somebody called him. He seemed like that kind of actor to me.
He'd pick up the phone. I'm going to go Sleepless. I do like both. It's not a discredit that I answered so quickly, but I like Sleepless, man. It's funny. I was just thinking about Sleepless like an hour ago. That's funny you say that.
I saw The Card Player within the history of this show, but I had not. I'd seen Sleepless before that, and I'd rewatched both since we've been doing this podcast. Weirdly, but I like Sleepless more. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
It's a little clumsy. Both of those films are a little clumsy, no doubt. And we'll talk about Argento and some of the things that have changed for him, especially, I would say, Stendhal syndrome and on.
Yes.
But with the occasional moment mixed in, like I'm one of the few people that will rep for Mother of Tears, believe it or not.
Yeah. No, I'll rep for it. I mean, it's, you know,
it's Gonzo. It's just Gonzo. Yeah. It's as close to him getting back to what he was doing in this era we're going to talk about as I think he's ever going to get. I don't think he's ever going to get back there.
You see, what is it? His newest one, Glasses.
I watched the first 10 minutes of it, and I like the first 10 minutes of it, and I quit, and I just never went back. I need to check it out.
It's good.
Yeah, I've heard mixed things, but I've heard it's good for the most part.
When I say good, like it's solid. Like it's definitely far above.
Yeah, is it Sleepless, Card Player territory? That kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, you're in the same realm, I guess, with those.
Yeah, I mean, there's some stuff. I mean, again, I've talked about this. There's some stuff of his that I know is generally shit on big time that I think is actually not half bad. I don't think his Phantom of the Opera is that bad.
No. See, no, I agree. Just to piggyback, Dark Glasses is probably like a touch above The Ward. Like this is for him what The Ward was for Carpenter. Like it's probably touch above The Ward.
Let me check it out.
I think it's better than The Ward. I'll go on record as saying that.
It wouldn't take much, probably. But I mean, The Ward's not bad. I mean, it's just mediocre. They both feel
a little bit anonymous from master filmmakers, but you still see little peeks through.
Well, that's going to be part of the interesting question I'm going to have a little later. That term, master filmmaker, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the only one I got, but I had to share that one because I thought about those two films when I rewatched this one. I thought, you know, I always think about late cycle D'Argento. And he's not the only Italian director whose late cycle has been rough.
No.
Matter of fact, a lot of Italian directors, their late cycle was brutal.
Yeah. Big time. Let's do a nice candy-related one. Tootsie Roll or Big League Chew?
You guys have Big League Chew up there?
Oh, yeah, man.
Do you? Wow, I didn't know that. I was eating
Big League Chew like in kindergarten, man.
Well, you were in the big leagues.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That shredded pouch was glory.
Yeah, I think they it's still around. You can still get it at Cracker Barrel and some places like that that sell retro candy.
Yeah,
down here, but for the most part, they've gotten rid of it because it resembles the tobacco pouch.
And I think that's probably the same thing here. Like, I don't know that it's necessarily available in convenience stores, but there's niche stores that would sell it.
Yeah, like Cracker Barrel still sells the candy cigarettes too.
Oh yeah, the pop. Do they Popeye cigarettes there? Is that what they are there too?
I don't know if they're Popeye cigarettes, but I recall Popeye cigarettes. I've seen that box.
Yeah, because those are what they are here. The candy cigarettes here are Popeye cigarettes.
Interesting.
Which is yeah.
Yeah, they you know, obviously discontinued those because kids were walking around with sticks of candy, look like cigarettes, and of course acting like they're smoking cigarettes. And of course the argument was psychologically it makes kids want to smoke. Yeah. I don't know about all that for sure. I chewed on candy cigarettes. No, for the record, I did smoke for years, so I guess maybe there is some logic to that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's see. Man, I like Big League Chew, man. It's some good bubble gum. It's mouthwatering. There's something about that gum that makes it really gets the saliva glands working hard. At least it used to. I don't know what it would be like now. Man, I loved that gum back in the day, though. The grape, especially. I was a sucker for the grape. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go Big League Chew. Tootsie Rolls are a very rare thing for me. That sticky candy, of course, as I get older, taffy, sticky-esque type candy, I become less and less of a fan of, mostly because I'm afraid I'm going to lose my fillings.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Every now and then, I'll have a moment where something gets stuck in my teeth. And I'm like, this fucking sucks. Why do I eat this garbage?
Yeah. You
know? And I spend an hour picking at my teeth like some kind of monster.
No, I hate it. That's one of my not phobias, but like something I'm very aware of and sort of a social anxiety I have is like stuff stuck in my teeth. Like,
yeah.
You eat bread, certain breads get stuck in your teeth, certain stringy meats. And I don't want to be walking around talking to people with like shit in my teeth.
Yeah, that's not good.
I'll just give you a kiddie with two quick ones, then we're done. Marky Bay or Ellen Barkin?
Ooh. That's interesting.
Yeah. I am a fan of both, I'll have you know, and I'm sure you are too.
Yeah, I am. A big fan of both. In ways that, you know, I can't explain. Yes. I'm trying to think. I'm going to go with Ellen Barkin. Mostly nice. Because I think she's aged very well.
You know what I meant to say? This is my bad. I said Marky Bay. I got my Markies mixed up. You know who I meant?
Did you mean Marky Post?
I meant Marky Post.
Well, now we're in a different game.
Let's do Marky. I want to redact that. It was Marky Post.
Now we're in a different game. Unfortunately, she's gone now. Markies.
Yes, sadly. Sadly, she is.
Man, I loved her from the minute I saw her. Well, I know her from the Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. Yeah.
And I was always bothered that Heather Thomas got all the attention.
I know, man. I'm all about Marky. I'm team Marky on that one.
Yeah, and I always thought Marky was the better looking lady.
I'm with you all the way.
Yeah, and then, of course, she did Night Court, and I watched Night Court as well. So, yeah, love me some Marky posts. Same shame, she passed away. Yeah.
I know.
Yep.
So is your answer Post over Barkin?
It's Post over Barkin. But Barkin over Bay.
Over Bay. Next up, Battle of the Markies. No, I am going to go. So this is the close one for me, but I got to go Barkin. I love both.
Yeah.
You know, I just, there's something about Barkin to me that is just very innate.
There's something kind of primal and animalistic about her.
There is. There's a simmering sort of.
It really starts with, for me, the Barkin that we've come to know and love really comes out of that Pacino film, Sea of Love, or I think it is.
Yeah, Sea of Love. And she's even really fun in the Oceans. I think it's Ocean's 13.
That sexuality just kind of oozes out.
Big time. But both, I love Marky, both Markies for that matter, and her. Okay, I'll give you one more. From Dusk Till Dawn or Waxwork?
Oh, that's tougher than you would think. That's an interesting one. Yeah. So Anthony Hickox just recently passed away. Mm-hmm. Sad. That's another director that I wish would have worked more. I think he's a seriously underrated director.
Oh, yeah.
He was really good. That one, I think he did the sequel. Well, maybe he didn't do the sequel to Hellraiser, because I think Hellraiser 1 and 2 are solid. It's everything after that that's questionable. That might have been Tony Randall, though, who did Ticks, I think. Or maybe Anthony Hickox did Ticks. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud at this point. You know, I'm trying to think. You know, I am a big fan of From Dusk Till Dawn. I like it quite a bit. It's not a great film. It definitely has that Quentin Tarantino opening.
Yeah, it does.
And it is bonkers and kind of fun because it brings Fred the Hammer back, and you got Tom Savini and, you know, Harvey Keitel doing a genre film, and, you know, George Clooney becoming a movie star. So it has elements.
Yeah, Lewis and Salma Hayek.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go Waxwork over that, though, because I like Waxwork for what it is. Like, it kind of dabbles in things a little bit more. I don't know how much I really like the Salma Hayek, yeah, but I don't know how much I really like the vampires in From Dusk Till Dawn. They're kind of just fodder.
I agree.
But there are some interesting makeups. I mean, the Fred Williamson one's good.
Yep.
The Salma Hayek one's good. The Tarantino one is this bizarre kind of like exaggeration.
It's Frankenstein or something.
Yeah. It's weird. It's just like some weird exaggeration of his already strangely shaped skull.
Yeah. That's true.
It does have one of the great macho moments, though. I don't know if Tarantino riffed on it from another movie. It feels like something he would have, but when the bartender or whatever counts to one and then George Clooney says two, he's like, yeah, go ahead, count to three. I dare you. I love that moment. Yeah. Some of the tattoo work, though, is a little dated in that movie.
Oh man, that that Clooney ink is very dated.
That new metal Clooney ink.
Oh man.
I like Waxwork a lot, though. We've talked about this over the years. I mean, me and you are both big fans of Waxwork, and we think it's underrated. I'm gonna go with Waxwork, man.
Okay, I'm pleasantly surprised. I thought you were gonna go Dusk, maybe.
I love Dusk. I don't think it's a bad. I don't think it's nearly as bad a movie as some people think it is.
No, I think it's a super fun film. Mm-hmm. Super fun. But I'm also Team Waxwork. I think Waxwork has some problems. It's a little goofy in spots, but it's one of my favorites as a kid. And now I love the concept. I think it's one of the best concepts in a horror film, or at least one of my favorite concepts.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you this really big sandbox to be able to go with all the classic movie monsters. They play with, shooting a little bit in black and white. The vampire sequence is really good. The werewolf, I think all the sequences are really strong. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's self-aware without being annoying about it. I love Waxwork. Yeah. So I'm also Waxwork on that one.
Nice. Nice.
So there we go. There you have it.
Yeah, there you go. I like it. All right. That's all for this or that. We're going to take a short break, come back. I think we might have went longer this intro than we did last intro, which is rare for us, but usually by the time we record show number two, we're like blasting through it, but not this time, baby. All right. Getting that supersize Halloween episode.
Yeah. The full size, not the fun size.
We're an hour and 6 minutes into this. All right. We're going to take a short break, come back, and we're going to talk Argento's Inferno. We'll be back right after this. It occurred to me when I was trying to find the song, I thought, well, what about that intro? It's so crazy. It's kind of this weird mix of like Italian cinema and Bohemian Rhapsody.
It is those things.
Suspirium.
Wild.
So Inferno, 1980, directed by one Dario Argento, an American college student in Rome and his sister in New York, investigate a series of killings in both locations where their resident addresses are the domain of two covens of witches. Covens. Well, Mark Borchardt in there. So we'll pick this one. I'm going to lead on it here. We got Lee McCloskey in the lead. Had a little bit of a moment in the late 70s, early 80s, a little TV action. I can't think of what he would mostly be known for.
Maybe this?
this, or maybe he was Kevin in Just One of the Guys. I think one of the guys, I think that maybe he was the boyfriend that she was kind of interested in, or maybe the guy that wanted to be her boyfriend, maybe the asshole. I can't remember. But I do remember him in that film. And
he was in Hamburger, the motion picture.
Yeah, he was in Hamburger, the motion picture, which I enjoy. It's not a good movie, but I do enjoy it. He's in a movie called Dirty Laundry, which looks kind of fun. A young man and a girlfriend unwillingly come into possession of a bag containing $1 million belonging to a drug smuggling ring. And it looks kind of fun. I don't know.
That Dirty Laundry freeze frame of that bald dude with the gun jumping is very enticing.
Yeah, it is. I can't remember the name of that actor, but he was in Swamp Thing and a few other things.
Yeah.
I remember that. Dirty Laundry, it has Frankie Valli playing Macho Marty Benedictine.
Wow.
And Sonny Bono as well. So, I don't know. Maybe, and Greg Louganis as Larry.
What a cast. That's pretty wild.
That's one of those, we had some hot people at the moment. Let's put them in and see what happens. So this one stars, like I said, Lee McCloskey. We'll talk about him a little bit. Irene Miracle is Rose. Eleonora Giorgio is Sarah. Dario Nicolodi, obviously, popping up in here. This might be one of the films where I think she's at her most beautiful, really.
Yeah, she's strong. She's always a strong and welcome.
Yeah. Presence. Although I have always been a bigger fan, and she reminds me of Daria quite a bit, and that's the Eleonora Georgi who I just mentioned.
Oh man.
At first when I'm watching this again, I'm thinking, wow, Dario Nicolodi really looks beautiful in this film. And then I realized, wait a minute, that's Eleonora Georgi.
I was going to mention her. She's beautiful. She and is. In a very sort of really vulnerable way. She's really well cast for the, like, her look is cast perfectly for what's required of her.
Yeah. We get Sasha Pitoff in here, who's popped up in some stuff. Most notably, for those who listened back when Todd and I were doing the show, Patrick Still Lives and a few other things.
Nice.
He's a very interesting kind of unibrow type of actor, not to mention the name. Talk about one that's an interesting actress. I don't know that she's done a whole lot. What's that lady? There's a lady in here that has incredible eyes.
Oh, Anna Pironi? No, Anna Pironi.
It's Anna Pironi. It's Anya Pironi. Yeah. She's the one that's in this classroom with the wind blowing. So. And she has, when I think of Italian gialli eyeballs, like, hers are the most prominent I can think of. She's a beautiful girl. I know her mostly as the babysitter in House by the Cemetery.
That's right.
Yep. She didn't do a whole lot of stuff. Ooh, man, I didn't know there was an Italian Frankenstein versus Dracula. Francia versus Dracula. Flunkia. Oh, looks like it must be a comedy.
Oh boy,
it looks boo. Man, it wow. The stills do not look good on that puppy. Yikes. She didn't have a long filmography, but she's in a couple things that I remember for. She was in Tenebrae as well. Mm-hmm. But her eyes are super memorable. And that's about it. I guess, you know, there's a few other odds and ends in here. Dario Argento wrote and directed this, mostly by himself. There are some uncredited writers. I guess I'll get into this. So he's coming off the kind of highs of Suspiria, right? Which
just say one thing. Forgive me for interjecting.
No. Go ahead.
It's important to know, especially in the context of this film. And it wasn't something, I'll be honest, as much as I'm a fan of the film, that I really found out until I was watching this film again and kind of going back into some of the trivia and sort of the what's what of it is Lamberto Bava and Mario Bava worked on this film heavily.
Yeah.
And it looks like at the time Argento, he's publicly said that he doesn't really like this film because he was very sick with hepatitis. Mm-hmm. And it looks like Mario Bava had a very heavy hand in this film. The last film Mario worked on. And when you watch this film, you do feel a very, very strong sense of Mario Bava. Some of the actresses and actors have said they recall working with Mario Bava like well over Dario Argento in terms of his presence.
Yep.
So you really feel that. I thought that was interesting. And also Bill Lustig is involved in the production on the New York side, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's interesting as well. So, yeah, that is some of the quote-unquote controversy of this one is how much did Dario – this is a poltergeist situation.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
So how much of this did Dario really direct? He's since kind of said that he directed quite a bit of it, but it seems like every other actor or actress on the shoot, man, sorry, shouldn't drink gin this early in the morning. It seems like every actor or actress on the shoot seems to remember Mario Bava and Lamberto Bava being around a lot more than Dario. Now, Dario was sick, but he does, as you know, as always, he does some of the things he always does, which is the murderer's hands. In this case, they're kind of claw-like. And there are some black glove sequences as well. There's gialli moments, but I got to say, in rewatching it, I did get a heavier Mario Bava vibe than I had gotten from the original time I watched it.
The production is very Bava with the colors and everything.
Oh yeah, yeah. The greens, the reds, the way he's mixing colors. Because everything is, there's no rhyme or reason to the lighting. The lighting in this film makes no sense whatsoever.
It just serves the purpose of atmosphere and just to be aesthetically pleasing.
So right off the bat, that's one of the things about this movie that you have to either buy or don't buy. It's completely stylized. So there's nothing that really has any rhyme or reason for me in this film. There's actually an underwater, a great underwater sequence for that matter.
Great. But, and the actress, Irene Miracle, mm-hmm. I think is the actress. So she was actually a trained swimmer. That was one of the reasons that she was picked for the role, because it's a pretty wild underwater sequence.
And it's a weird sequence too, because it's like, you know, there's this ballroom underwater under this building. She decides to go down this little hole. It just, none of it makes any sense. Nobody would do that.
No, I'm watching that thinking, oh my God, like this is a worse decision than the stuff that Sandler's doing in Uncut Gems.
Yeah. I mean, it's just
a bad decision.
Yeah. It's a bad decision altogether. Later on, McCloskey will make a bad decision going into a small hole.
Wow.
I just don't understand. I guess, you know, you could argue that mankind's made a bunch of mistakes in their life going into holes, but you know, crass jokes aside, it's a really weird kind of setup. The movie just automatically jumps right into it. And this one's all about atmosphere. This one's all about bonkersness. And I don't know, you know, we'll never know how much Mario Bava was involved. But we'll know that he was somewhat involved. And I feel like most, if not some of the design of the sequences falls on Argento, but it feels like it's one of these weird things where it feels like it's designed by Argento, possibly shot by the Bavas.
Yeah.
Because the camera's not moving much. Not all the time anyway. Dario's coming off of Suspiria where he moves the camera a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
There's just moments that feel very Bava-esque compared to the kind of Argento we were used to. Now, in saying that, I've seen this film a couple of times. Never really been a big fan of it. Never really cared for it. Always thought it was just an exercise in style and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Watching it again this time, I still feel like it's mostly an exercise in style. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, I kind of enjoyed it this time. I don't know. Again, this is, you know, I'm not going to sit here and eat crow, because to be honest with you, I still think it's a mess. But
yes,
I think it's a stylish, and because I think it's somewhat short, I guess it's like 100 minutes long or something like that.
Yeah, 106.
Yeah, it works. It works for those reasons. And the bonkersness of it actually helps the movie. For what I don't like about Suspiria, what I do love about Suspiria is that it's a vision of Argento. It's like it comes straight out of his brain. It couldn't have came out of anybody else's. Some of this, I feel, is the same way. Some of the production design, some of the other stuff. But it does, in hindsight, look a little bit like Bava-esque type stuff as well. So yeah. If any of you ever get that vibe and you're a huge Bava fan, you won't be remiss and knowing that now, because that's kind of the big controversy. Now, I didn't even know. I got to be honest with you. I didn't even know until today, because I never read the trivia, that Bill Lustig was involved at all.
Yeah, he was trying to get Daria Nicoldi to be the lead in Maniac, like the female, the Carolyn Monroe role.
Wow.
She turned it down.
Again, one of the early film nerds who became a filmmaker.
Yeah, Bill Lustig.
Yeah, one of those guys, kind of like Fred Decker and those guys.
Yeah.
You know, was seeing Italian films and all kinds of other films and drive-ins, and not drive-ins, but on 42nd Street, and just really became a huge film buff and turned that into a career. The movie is, it's one crazy kind of weird set piece after another.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I think the rhyme or reason of Dream Logic serves the piece well. I can see why folks love it. I really can. It definitely has a cult feel, no doubt. But it also has that weird Argento-esque logic of none of this makes any sense, but it looks really cool.
Yep, 100%.
There's been people over the years who've, you know, I think Kim Newman has called this his masterpiece over Suspiria. There's some of our friends think this is better than Suspiria. I wanna say that I think I'm on board with that.
Ooh.
I think this is better than Suspiria. Now, I think, as we all know, I still think Deep Red is the apex moment for Dario for me.
Okay.
I think everything after that is lesser or greater. No greater, but it's somewhat, you know, it's somewhat diminishing returns in some ways with a few odds and ends in there. Some of the set pieces in opera, even though I don't think opera is a great film, there's still moments in it that are amazing. Some of the stuff in Trauma is great, even though I don't think Trauma is a great film. Some of the stuff in Stendhal Syndrome is great, even though I don't think it's great, a great film either. And then, of course, we just talked about Sleepless and The Card Player. And then I'm trying to think Phenomena and some of these other films. Mother of Tears. There's moments. There's always moments. That's one thing Dario's good at. More so than like a Jess Franco or somebody like that. He definitely can get some moments. It's really a shame in some ways that they couldn't get some of the, I mean, I know there was rumors that Nancy Allen was trying, they were trying to get her in for some of the American stuff.
Oh man, you brought up a great point. You might be going here. You're going to talk about who the male lead was supposed to be?
No, I only know about the female. I only know Nancy. I know from reading articles in the past about Nancy Allen that she was approached. And so, I thought that was interesting because De Palma is very Argento-esque in some ways.
He absolutely is. He's a big fan of Argento, by all accounts, from what I understand. But interestingly, the male lead that Argento wanted, because he had a bit of cachet after Suspiria, Paramount released it, made some money, and he wanted James Woods in mm-hmm. the Mark Elliott role. So it was going to be Nancy Allen and James Woods. James Woods at the time was doing Videodrome, so he had to pass it up. Now, again, all sort of personal and political stuff aside, as an actor, I love James Woods.
Yeah.
I see him go down this feverish rabbit hole. And James Woods was never afraid to work with genre filmmakers. He worked with Carpenter. He worked with Cronenberg. It would have been very interesting to see, because I think you and I have said off the air, and I'm sure it's a pretty public thing, and I don't think it really affects the film for me too much, but Lee McCloskey is a bit of a void. And, you know, I don't think that he's necessarily bad. I just think he's kind of non-existent. Like, to me, he makes Jameson Parker in Prince of Darkness look like electrifying.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about this with the bland communion wafer, right?
Yeah, he's exactly that. But to me, I almost, and again, this is me probably like bulletproofing the film critically for myself, is I'm okay with that because I feel like he's more just a vessel to get us through this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you add Woods to the film, does that change the dynamic and the performance? Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
No, interesting kind of two sides of the coin on that.
But. Yeah. A vessel or avatar, however you want to look at it, McCloskey's purpose is just to look somewhat good and just kind of move the plot along. There's never really any acting moments, in my opinion, with him. That's kind of all given to the female actresses in the film. And they're all pretty good. Some of them a little bit more over the top than others. But they're all really good in the roles they have. And of course, this gets into the world of, you know, Argento and his, you know, I don't think, you know, he was ever attacked for the Me Too movement or anything like that. But, you know, his kind of love of the kind of sexuality of, you know, women and the way he uses them. And, you know, some of the controversy of the way he uses his own daughter and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, I think for him, it's the... There's not a lot of nudity in this film. Is there any nudity in this film? I guess there.
I don't think there's any nudity in. Oh, there's some nipples through a wet shirt.
Yeah. There's a little bit of sexuality, not much, but I think that, you know, he ties sexuality to horror as a vulnerability element, and I think that works for the most part. It's not just there for, you know, I mean, even in something like Night of the Creeps, which we just talked about in the intro, there's a gratuitous shower scene. For no reason other than to show boobs.
Yep.
There's no reason to have it in there other than just have the boobs show. Mm-hmm. And a scene where the lead actress in that film, Jill McCormick or whatever her name is, she changes her top and you see her boobs. That's gratuity. This is like a lot of, I think, Argento stuff. He's tying sexuality to vulnerability. And I think that's what Gialli does. It's a sexual genre in general. Now, in saying that, this is not full-blown Gialli. This is part of, if you aren't familiar with Argento, his little trilogy of films he likes to call the Three Mothers trilogy, which is Suspiria, this one, and Mother of Tears.
Yep.
Now, I will say this. As a trilogy, it's very interesting. And I enjoy that trilogy. If it gets released on 4K as a trilogy, I'm buying that trilogy.
Oh, yes.
Even though I'm not the world's biggest Suspiria fan. But that's not to say I don't appreciate Suspiria. I do. I think it's got some qualities that are unique unto itself and Argento-esque to the nth degree. And what's interesting is that if Bava is actually shooting some of this, it just shows you what an influence Bava was on Argento, that mm-hmm. he would keep kind of some of this stuff around, right? Because, you know, Argento's sick. He's relying on second unit. Bava's sick. His son's there, but, you know, Bava's, you know, he's older and ill, you know, lifetime smoker, guy didn't take care of himself. I think just bad health elements in general. Bad heart, I believe, something like that. But, you know, visually, Bava is one of the great influencers on so many filmmakers. We know that. And Argento being one of those. So it's interesting that, you know, he kind of curbs that style and just kind of goes with it. But of course, then again, I think about Bava and I think about the years that he stepped in behind the camera for a lot of directors and just kind of helped get films made. You know, he was a workmanlike director, so, you know, he wouldn't always take credit. He just kind of stepped behind the camera and just get it done. And he was able to do that. So maybe that's what he implied and did here. Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed this on a, I guess it's the fourth or the fifth time I've watched it. I think the bonkersness of it is what makes it special. It's not too overly bonkers, but it's bonkers enough with clawed hands and eyeballs through drapes, which you know how I feel about that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, underwater sequences and fire. And it's just, it's a metal, a great fire stunt, too. Yeah. Great fire stunt. We always got to mention those. But it's a heavy metal horror movie. It's well, of the period of 1980 heavy metal horror movie, kind of like new wave of British heavy metal, like Iron Maiden / you know, that kind of stuff. Judas Priest, early Judas Priest, that kind of stuff. It just feels like that kind of stuff D'Argento was really into at the time. And this is the question I want to ask, because I've asked this on the Not a Bomb show, and I want to ask you, who's more of an Argento, maybe not expert, but certainly a huge fan. But has there ever been a director who's had a steeper fall from being considered a master to a has-been than Dario Argento? Now, he'll always be a master in some regard because he's at least made one or two great films. But has there ever been, can you think of anybody off the top of your head? Because this is tougher than you think, who had a steeper fall. He's managed to keep working. I will say that. But I mean, I know as a fan, we just talked about this in the intro, there's stuff you like. But can you think of anybody?
So off the top of my head, in the interest of time, I can't. And the thing of this is you have to look at the highs that he reached to really contrast them with the lows. Because for me, for my money, and again, it's a subjective thing, but to me, he's a favorite filmmaker, like one of my favorite filmmakers, and also I think one of the greatest genre filmmakers. You know, you look at the run he had up to and including opera. So you got Bird with Crystal Plumage, Cat of Nine Tails, Four Flies on Grey Velvet, Deep Red, Suspiria, Inferno, Tenebrae, Phenomena, Opera. That's an incredible run. Mm. And then lesser stuff, but to reach those highs, to me, and I always use this as sort of like the creative apex. You know, for me, I'm a big soul music guy. So for me, it's like Stevie Wonder in the 70s. Like he had that Stevie Wonder in the 70s run from 1970 until 1987. Mm-hmm. 17 years, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 very good to great films.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He just seemed gold. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, I can't think of another filmmaker that fell off as much as he did. Now, I don't know how much of that has to do with the Italian film industry's lack of budgets or anything else. Because, you know, that could have factored in. But then again, Bava was working with a low budget. We've seen films like The Void, which I keep talking about, for $82,000. So, you know, it's a shame. But like you'd sort of said, we'll always have his great films.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, some of the other Italian directors, well, I mean, you could argue some of the films in the 80s. I mean, obviously, we love 80s Italian-American stuff. when they came over here and were making stuff. But Argento, he kind of didn't do that. He kind of didn't come over, and he always would kind of stubbornly, I guess Phenomena is kind of that way. But he kind of, he's kind of always kind of stubbornly been Argento, hasn't he?
Yeah, he worked back home. He didn't really come over. Like, even oddly, even Damiano Damiani, who was like, you know, a master sort of crime political thriller filmmaker, makes Amityville 3D over here.
Yeah.
Chasing the, which is just the weirdest thing ever. But a lot of his contemporaries came over, some didn't. You know, but it just, it's strange to me, yeah, that, you know, the drop that happened. But
yeah, because he never came over here and made a post-apocalyptic film or one of the Florida-based films. I don't think he ever made any of those.
No, he stayed, and he pretty much, like, not pretty much, he stayed in the horror genre. Martino made other films. Mm-hmm. All the other filmmakers made other films.
Yeah.
Fulci made other films. He made spaghetti westerns. And I know Argento has a couple things in his filmography that, like The 5 Days, for example, that, you know, is outside the horror genre. Everything else is horror.
Yeah. I mean, he'll forever have a place in my heart anyway, as, you know, part screenwriter for Once Upon a Time in the West. And
oh, yeah, that's right.
Being part of that and whatnot. But yeah, it was an interesting question I posed to the guys over at Not a Bomb and Jose from Watch Skip Plus, because off the top of my head, it's really hard for me to think of anybody else. There's been people who've been hit with controversy that have fallen hard, but I'm talking about the actual work and the deterioration of the work. It was like, you know, after Opera, and again, Stendhal Syndrome is pretty good. We obviously as film fans can find things and stuff, but I mean, it's almost like he disappeared off the face of the earth in some weird way.
And this kind of plays into that thing Tarantino said about, oh, filmmakers, 10 great films, whatever. I don't necessarily think that's the case. Certain filmmakers like Altman, Bergman, Kurosawa was pretty much blind making color films with virtually no eyesight. So
yeah,
that's a case by case thing. But, I wonder, Carpenter slipped, but, you know, look at the back end of his filmography, right? Like, there's some pretty subpar stuff in there. Like, you know, Memoir. Vampires is fun, but it's not great.
No.
It's decent. It's solid, but it's really made solid by the Woods performance more than anything.
Yeah, that late cycle Carpenter stuff is...
Late cycle Carpenter is not very good. Like, post They Live... Well, okay. I guess you got a few good things. You got Memoirs, Mouth of Madness, which I don't like as much as everyone else, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I like that one, but I think that was kind of a comeback. And then everything after that to me is a bit of a lesser than.
Village of the Damned, I've never actually seen. Escape from LA is fine, not great. Vampires, fine, not great. Ghost of Mars, I like, but it's not a great film.
No, none of those are great films.
No. So, I mean, you know, he slipped a little.
Yeah.
Probably not as steep of a drop off, but, you know, we'll always have the early stuff.
Well, he worked less too, right? I mean, you know,
he was content to just,
Argento was still trying to crank out one or two every one to two, three years.
Yeah.
So he was trying to recapture the magic. It's just like he never could.
No, it's true.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I still like the set piece that is this movie. I like the apartment building. I like all that stuff, and it still works really well. I think, yeah, of the three Mother of Tears films, this is probably my favorite one. That's weird for me to say, because I used to have a very visceral reaction to this one. I used to have a very kind of ugly, empty reaction to this one. But as time has gone on, I've come to enjoy it. I still don't think I enjoy it nearly as much as you do, or some of our listeners and friends, but I do think it's better than I thought it was. And even saying that it's better than Suspiria is probably going to irritate some people to no end.
That's okay.
That's all I got.
I'm going to rip through. We have run very long today, but that's the way we do it. I've said this might be, in my opinion, his most overlooked film. You know, he's got so many that are really, really fantastic. Phenomena gets a lot of buzz because it's very metal-y and just bonkers, and Opera's got some cool stuff. But I feel like this is his most overlooked as someone who really loves Argento. It's a very heightened, stylistic film. Like we said, the purples, the blues, the pinks. I love the color palette for this film. It feels very Bava to me. The Emerson score to me is very heavy-handed. That's one thing I, you know, Goblin's work with Argento is very hand in glove. I'd almost like to see a fan scoring of this film because, you know, obvious statement here, scores for films can really enhance or detract from the mood and the atmosphere. And for a film that is really about atmosphere and aesthetics, it just feels very heavy-handed sometimes and very intrusive, some of the Emerson stuff. And I'm okay with bonkers, but I don't know. Interesting, this film really plays on... Were you going to say something?
No, I was thinking about that because one of the things that I think... Emerson's interesting because I'm pretty sure it was him that did the Murder Rock, the Fulci film. Yeah.
Some stuff for Murder Rock, yeah.
And that one works for whatever reason, but this one doesn't. It's around the same period.
I'll tell you why it works. Because the film's called Murder Rock.
Well, that's probably the case too. Yeah.
That definitely factors in. But yeah, it's interesting. There's moments in this one that work, but some that don't. This one has a very fairy tale feel, and I've heard that this one is very much Argento riffing on Hansel and Gretel, which is very evident. It feels also to me Alice in Wonderland, right down to the visual cue of going down the holes with both the male and female characters. It twists and turns. It kind of gives us a few Janet Leigh's, you know, in this.
Yeah.
We get a few Janet Leigh's, right? So I think that's interesting. And again, I'm okay with the characters being vessels or avatars to kind of get us from set piece to set piece because we can appreciate art that is more abstract alongside art that is maybe, you know, a little more realistic or, you know, there's room for both. So I'm okay with a filmmaker, you know, as I know you are as well, doing something different. You know, the production design is impeccable in this for me. The lobby with the yellow corridors and the lavender lights, and it's all really in service of the atmosphere. So that's really going to, you know, you're going to give into it or you're not. It is very dreamlike. There's wind blowing through a university class with this classical music playing and a cat. And it's just, it's very bizarre.
It is.
We get the Suspiria taxi scene, part two.
Yes.
Right? And I love that scene. And like I said to you, I really love Eleonora Georgi in this. I think she's beautiful and she has a very vulnerable, expressive face. I would have loved her to like to repurpose this as sort of the principle throughout the film. I think the problem with shifting perspectives, if I do have a gripe with this film, is it becomes too episodic. And there's even moments when Sasha Pitoev as the Kazanian, the antique guy.
Yeah.
He's sort of takes over as a principal for a bit. So it feels a little bit episodic at times. Whereas if you take out the McCloskey or just keep Georgie and like Sarah and Mark Elliott, those two as sort of the Hansel and Gretel, to me, it would have worked a little more effectively.
Right? Yeah. I mean, I think the only thing that works about that element is that it gives you some surprise moments, right?
It definitely does. It gives you the Janet Leigh's. Right.
Yeah, it gives you the Janet Leigh moments. Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a spoiler because we're not telling you who does what and when, but that works. And honestly, that's one of the things that I think is to the benefit of this film in some ways. But man, yeah. I do like the first actress the most. Not the first one, but the second one.
Yeah. Nora Georgi, same.
Yeah.
Not even close. To me, she's great. Daria is always great. Daria, let's give her flowers too. She co-wrote this film, but for whatever reason, she didn't want to wrestle with getting the credit. I wish she had of. I think she's an underrepresented creative force in Dario's world. And I don't know about the politics and dynamics of that, either in the Italian film industry or them domestically, why that was. But I think she's always been someone that didn't get enough critical acclaim for her creative contributions to his films.
Right.
What else do we got here? I like that this one, and it's something I'd never really realized or put together before, but so the three mothers, there's the mother of size, S-I-G-H-S, the mother of darkness, and the mother of tears. And this one very purposely talks about the mother of darkness not being a magician, but an alchemist.
Right.
And I found that very interesting, you know, for whatever reason, right? It's not just about sort of witches. This one's more about science than magic or movie science.
Yeah, yeah, movie science with a little bit of Satan mixed in there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, lots of good set pieces, lots of good kills in this. I'll tell you, the parents of these two, talk about trust fund kids. One's a musicology major, one's a poet.
neither one of them have ever actually paid for an apartment because they have the most gigantic apartments ever.
In Roman, New York.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, come on. No poet lives in an apartment that size.
No, not at all. Just for the animal people, some cats are thrown.
Yeah, there's some rough cat stuff here.
Rough cat stuff, and not awful, but enough that it would be maybe a bit distressing to some.
I think if you're a cat lover, it could be a bit distressing, yes.
And the fact that the cats eat mice, which again, mileage is going to vary on how much that bothers you.
Yeah.
Fun fact, Dario's the Black Glove killer hands in all of the Black Glove killer scenes. So we get the supernatural mixed with some of that stuff. One thing, you know, that other than sort of the, like I said, kind of jumping around a little bit, that doesn't quite sit with me well is that whole cats and rats plague thing. I think it was one of those ideas that probably sounded better on paper than it does in person.
The rats thing really doesn't work for me.
It doesn't work at all. It's ridiculous. A couple more notes quick. You mentioned it. The fire dummy through the skylight is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's 2-for-1 deal. Fire stunt, dummy death. Good stuff. Other than that, I just want to say this. There's times in this film where I'm watching it back and having seen Bo is Afraid now, I really feel like Aster leans into some of the aesthetics in this film.
Interesting. I haven't seen Bo is Afraid yet.
Yeah, yeah. There's set piece production design in this that really, very sort of theatrical.
Interesting.
You know, really, there's stuff in Bo is Afraid that I'm like, wow, this is, you know, fably in a way that Bo is Afraid is also. So I'd never really made that connection. Also, this reminds me a bit of Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, okay.
Production design, again, the whole fairy tale element.
Okay. Yeah. No, I can see it.
And I always love that mirror sequence with the skeleton.
Yeah. 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 It's pretty good.
It's fun. Anyway, those are my notes.
There's a great simple mirror sequence in Killers of the Flower Moon, by the way. I was trying to think of the last time we had seen Georgi in a film, and I'm thinking it was that. Didn't we do a Damiani film with Gemma, Giuliano Gemma in it?
Yes, we did.
Kind of a cop film. What was it called?
I think it was. Is it not? I Am Afraid. What was it?
Here it is. A Man on His Knees.
A Man on His Knees. Great film.
Yeah.
She also did some Don Matteo episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Un Uomo in Ginocchio.
Nice.
Ginocchio, maybe. Anyway, yeah, that's a pretty good Gemma kind of crime film.
That's a good one, man. Social commentary. That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. I remember seeing her in something we did not too long ago, and I feel like that was the last one we did like that, I think. I don't know when we did that, but Jesus. I can't keep track of when we do things.
The Tarantula she's in briefly, but that was many moons ago for us.
Many moons ago, and I think she's only in it briefly, if I remember right. Like that's her debut.
Yeah.
But I don't know if A Man on His Knees was this year or last year.
Oh, God, it was many years ago.
Was it?
Man. We did that probably like 5 years. I feel like it was like 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, man.
Man, maybe it was.
It definitely wasn't this year or last year.
Interesting.
Wow. Look that up, but I'm pretty confident.
Yeah, I mean, the way time works, I don't doubt that you're not right. But, man, I tell you what, it feels like forever ago. But yet, at the same time, it feels like this past year.
I know.
All right. Well, anyway, that's our thoughts on Argento, Whiskey, and Make or Breaks, MVTs. Let's see here. What do I got? I got, I can't give the MVT to Argento because of all the hubbub behind the scenes. Ultimately, he is responsible, but I don't know how much of it he's really kind of responsible for. So even though I appreciate that, I can't really give it to him. So I'm going to give it to Georgi because I really think her sequence is my favorite sequence.
Strong. Yeah.
It's my favorite of the sequences. I love it the most. And everybody's good in the film, though. I'm not trying to knock any of the... Well, I mean, obviously, McCloskey's not really doing anything. Except,
he's okay, though. Like, he's not terrible. Yeah. He's an avatar for this, right?
He's just very vanilla. He's just very much there. Make or break. Oof. So there's some good sequences here. I think I'm going to go back to the Georgie. See, I like when she's going through the library or whatever it is, the area, and she kind of happens upon the what looks like a cook or a blacksmith. It's never really an alchemist.
An alchemist is exactly what it is.
Is it, you know, I mean, well, you could say a cook and a blacksmith mixed together. That's an alchemist, maybe.
That's an alchemist.
I like that sequence because that's once the bonkersness starts to dial up.
Exactly.
Now, the water sequence is really good, and I actually think it's one of Argento's best set pieces. Nice. I really like it, but I'm going to go with that sequence. And, you know, in a world where I never thought I'd say this, I'm going to give this film a 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
I would have never have rated this thing probably higher than a 6 back in the day. But I'm going to go 7 out of 10. I quite enjoyed this watch. I still don't think it's amazing, but I think it's good. I think it's good. But go ahead. Go ahead. I know you got to go soon. You're getting the whispers.
I'm getting pulled. The music's playing here.
Man on his knees. 2020 is when we did that. 2020. I found it.
3 years ago. In between what you and I said. Make or break. The sequence with Eleanora Georgie, man. I loved it. My favorite sequence in the film. She has a certain air of vulnerability. The camera loves her. Plus all the production design stuff with the blues and the colors pops really nicely in that sequence. MVT, I'm not going to go with Argento because I don't know how much of it was Bava or Argento, as you'd said. It's just the overall visuals, production design, everything that makes this film a visual feast. My score is obviously higher than yours, but we're in the same realm as we always are. It's an 8 out of 10. Nice. I love this film. Nice. I think it's Argento's most underappreciated film. And that's it.
Probably where, again, our biggest gap is, right, as an Argento, as film lovers. So
sometimes I love sizzle and sometimes you love steak, right? I'm a little more on the sizzle scale. You're more on the steak scale. Yeah.
We want to thank everybody for listening and happy Halloween. Be careful out there. As always, check out the other podcast, Not a Bomb, Watch Skip Plus, Chinchroker vs. Punter, Raiders of the Podcast, See Here Podcast, Murder Clickers, love that album, Night of the Living Podcast. Man, Chinchroker vs. Punter, I think I said those guys already, but anyway, that's a lot of them out there. I need to just record a roll call, but then again, some new podcast will come along. And so anyway,
let us know if we're not mentioning you. We want to mention you.
I don't want to mention what we're covering next week or not yet because I'm not 100% sure I can be here. I need to talk to you about that off the air. So
we'll talk behind the curtains.
Yeah. I want to thank everybody for listening. Yes. Have a every happy spooky season and adios.
Happy Halloween, gang. Check those bags for razor blades and other bad stuff. We love you all. Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.